This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When Claudia Horwitz was young, she worked to raise awareness about hunger and homelessness. She was passionate and committed. So were the people she worked with. How could you do that kind of work if you weren't? But she quickly noticed a high burnout rate among activists she was working with. People dropped out of political organizing for all kinds of reasons. Lack of money, exhaustion, they weren't seeing progress, illness, addiction. And Claudia wanted to find a way to make activism itself more sustainable. So she founded Stone Circles at Stone House. They're located in Mebane. She's the executive director, and Claudia Horwitz joins us today on The State of Things. Good to have you here.
It's great to be here, Frank. I'm a big fan of the show and a longtime sustainer of the station.
Bless you. And sustainability is your theme.
That's right.
The number is 1-800-96-NO. tell us about Stone House and why you founded Stone House.
The Stone House has been around for 6 years, and Stone Circles kind of predated it by 11 or some years. We wanted to have a space where folks that were practitioners in social change work could come for a different kind of experience, an experience of retreat, of training, of connection, of community, and in a sense, a place where they could not totally leave their obligations and commitments at the door, but place them in a, you know, a little bit of a different space, get back in touch with who they were, why they started doing the work in the first place.
Forgive me for interrupting, but It seems to me that the people are, I mean, they are connected. They've got this network of people they're working with on a cause that has, for one reason or another, drawn them. They feel called to do this kind of work. That's their network. Those are their people. Aren't? What else do they need?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that level of connection is actually really vital, for sure. I think the additional things that folks need are, one, I've always had a firm belief that people need some kind of practice, some kind of daily practice. Some people might think of that in spiritual terms. Some people might think of it in secular terms. But some way every day to come home to yourself and to who you are, your deepest truth. It often, I think, happens most powerfully in silence, some kind of silent practice, but not necessarily. So I think that's essential. And then there's a whole set of skills and capacities that really lend themselves to transformation. So it's great for us to be doing the work in community. And I think social change by definition is a collective enterprise. But there's a whole other level of kind of developmental training that can help in what you're doing.
Well, let's talk about the practice part of this first. I mean, it sounds like it might also be ritual, something that you do every day apart from the hard work of creating social justice in whatever form it takes. Why is that important? And why? I mean, because I can hear people saying to you, oh, I'd love to do that, Claudia. I don't have time. I'm out there making the world better. Right.
Right. And I always tell those people that the Dalai Lama meditates about 6 hours a day and he's running an entire country in exile. So I'm pretty sure you can find 20 minutes to sit down and be quiet with yourself. I do think it is ritual. I think it marks a special kind of time, which is how I think about ritual. And I think it's essential because we get very caught up in the day to day and the mind gets very caught up in what's happening, you know, moment to moment. And we're operating by definition a little bit closer to the surface. You know, we're having to make decisions quickly, et cetera. And to be able to drop below the surface to kind of what is lurking at the bottom, you know, again, where is that wisdom that you know to be true? If you are from a traditional religious path, you need to connect back in with that path, read the sacred text, pray, etc. If you're on more of a spiritual path, you need to connect back with those practices. And then there's folks, of course, for whom they're not connected to a specific tradition or path. And there are still plenty of ways that those people find to come back to what's most real.
There's a suggestion in what you're saying that we can easily lose ourselves because of these day-to-day kinds of questions on the surface and not be rooted. But aren't we connected to the cause? If it's homelessness, if it's criminal justice, that thing is the same every day. I mean, it's changing roughly. But why is the connection to that, which is we're deeply passionate about, not the thing that roots us. How do people get lost, even though the cause is the same every day?
No, I think that's a great point. I do think that connection is partly what roots us, for sure. But it can also place us in a place of reactivity very easily, because we're constantly pushing against something. We're constantly trying to change conditions. We're constantly trying to change people's minds, change economic structures, change the nature of oppression and how it plays out. I mean, it's all about, you know, changing things. And that is the work to hold out, you know, some kind of vision of, if you're a Christian, for example, the kingdom, or, you know, Buddhists would put it a different way, right? Mm-hmm. But we hold mm-hmm. out some kind of prophetic vision. And if we're just stuck in this place where everything is about short-term decisions, you know, cutting folks off at the knees, cutting the dialogue off before it even begins, we're not going to be very skillful if we spend all our time there.
Yeah, and it seems to me it devolves very quickly into narcissism. If change is your goal, then you don't win until you dominate, and then that puts you at the center of the universe, which can be pretty destructive, I suppose.
Sure. I mean, we all have egos. Part of becoming human is ego formation. That's what kids learn when they're little and they say no for the first time. I have agency here, you know? So our egos are important. And I think many spiritual traditions would say those egos, once formed, need to be burned a bit. They need to be dissolved. And we need to do the work, and then we need to let go of the fruit of the labor.
It's interesting. Martin Luther King developed a 10-point pledge that all of the activists who were going to be part of his movement, the SCLC, had to take and repeat. And number two on that list is, remember always that the nonviolent activist seeks justice and reconciliation, not victory.
I love it.
It's wonderful, but then I have to go back and say, well, wait a minute, Dr. King, how can I seek justice if I don't win?
Well, I think he wasn't saying we don't want to win. I think he was saying if you are only directing your energy towards victory, you miss all the transformation in the process. I mean, if you look at all of the legacy now of the civil rights movement, that came just as much at the hand of losing in certain battles as it did at the hand of winning. And I think both are important.
You went through some of this yourself. Tell us a little bit about how you began your journey in social activism.
My first job out of college was with a national organization that was working on economic justice, on hunger and homelessness. I didn't have much of a political analysis back then. I had grown up in a fairly progressive or liberal Jewish household up north. Certainly, my mom was very committed to democratic ideals, so I had that going for me. But I got recruited out of college to take this job, and I got really schooled in how politics works, how money works. And for the first time, I started to realize what happens when you organize people and how organized people can start to confront organized money, which is sort of the essence of organizing, really. And I learned a lot from that experience, and it did some damage to my psyche, too.
Well, tell us about that.
Just realizing a few years into it that I was working 12-hour days and not taking very good care of myself and getting migraine headaches and getting some bouts of depression. And I had to eventually stop for a little while and take care of that.
What was that like for you? I mean, you're committed to this ideal. There's this thing that has to change. You're working hard. And now you're having to give up. You're walking away.
It was really humbling. And I'm so glad I went through it, because now when I see other folks that are in some kind of struggle with their own health, whether it's physical health or emotional, mental health, I have so much compassion, and I've been there and I still get there today. It's not like I've figured something out.
Is that the hard part for people who are engaged in this, acknowledging that they need some help because it feels like a kind of a surrender?
I think that's definitely part of it, although I've seen a huge change in the last two decades since I started doing this work. I think there was a trifecta of the Bush years and the war and 9/11. A lot of activists started coming out of the closet as really desiring more of some kind of healing or spiritual grounding. And I'm really thankful that that's happened because there's a lot of resource out there for folks. And now people are starting to look for it.
At Stonehouse, you practice something that you call radical hospitality. What is that?
We do. So we've got this 70-acre farm retreat. And the idea is that we welcome anyone and everyone, people of all traditions and no tradition. The welcome is very warm without being like overly smothering in any way. We don't put a lot of rules out there. We just expect people to really respect the space. We try to accommodate folks in whatever their needs happen to be. We serve incredibly delicious, nourishing food that's grown, some of it on site or all locally sourced, produced in our kitchen. And the idea is really to welcome the stranger as a friend, no matter who they are, what tradition they come from, age, race, you know, of course, it doesn't matter. And that's been one of the most unsuspecting beauties of that place is how many different folks have found a sense of that home and coming home to themselves there.
People just wander in and then they find themselves in a community, or do you organize retreats? How does it go?
Mostly it's organized. We have organized retreats, meditation and yoga. We do our own leadership training, and then people can rent the space for their own use. A lot of social change nonprofits from North Carolina have passed through there. But we love folks wandering in and just wandering the grounds. And one of our favorite programs is called Soul Sanctuary, and it's free, and it's for activists and organizers. It's 5 days. We feed people, and folks don't have to do anything except come share dinner and share fellowship. But otherwise, they're free to sleep all day or make art or wander in the pasture or go practice meditation or talk to the other folks there. It's a well-structured pause, is how I like to think of it. And that's what I really believe people need more of in their lives.
We will do the same right now, a well-structured pause, and then we'll return with Claudia Horwitz, who's founder and executive director of Stone Circles at Stonehouse. Stay with us on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today we're talking about spirituality for activists. Claudia Horwitz is the executive director of Stone Circles at Stonehouse in Mebane. And we were talking about, I want to get back to your personal journey, because when we left you, you were having migraines and you weren't really able to do the work. What happened next for you?
I resisted getting help for a little while. And then I realized I got to the point of not really being able to function in my job. And I was getting ready to leave anyway. I had gotten so close to grassroots organizers, and I wanted to work more directly with folks that were homeless and formerly homeless that were fighting for their own economic justice. And so I took what would be the first of many breaks that I've taken in my life. Those breaks have changed over time. Now they look more like, you know, structured retreats. But at that point, it was just literally going home to my parents' house for a little while and getting some medical help for the headaches and seeing a therapist for the depression and not really knowing what would be next. And, you know, that's a scary thing. I was young enough then, mid-20s, that I just thought, well, you know, this is a one-time thing. I'm just discovering these ailments and I'll figure it out and move on. And of course that, you know, life is a spiral. You keep coming back to the same place over and over. But out of that, I ended up, you know, healing and starting a project in Philadelphia called Empty the Shelters. That was a collaboration between college students and homeless leaders in the homeless and formerly homeless community. And that was a powerful kind of next step for me, because it brought me out more into doing my own thing, you know, in community, but not based on an original organization. And we modeled that after Freedom Summer. So back to the civil rights movement, actually, and got a bunch of young people to work in Philadelphia for the summer with a lot of these social justice organizations, doing everything from direct action to service to education. And that was where I started to really realize that this question of sustainability was much broader than just my own experience. I had had my own challenging experience, and now I was starting to see the patterns unfold among a lot of other people. And it became more of a meta question.
I was going to ask you whether, because it's one thing, especially when you're young, you heal, you get over it, and you say, okay, that's done. And then you go back to the same old nonsense, right? And you don't see the patterns, but you began to see them emerge. And I would think it would be even more stressful and perhaps more dangerous in terms of sustainability when it's your organization, because now not only are you invested in the cause, but it's your club, you know, and you want to make sure it proved to everybody essentially that you were right to begin with. Hard not to be seduced into that form of kind of ego. This is my organization. Watch this. I was right.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that when you're working with folks who have been in such precarious positions in their own lives economically, it puts things in a different perspective. And you're really working for liberation from a different doorway in that way. And you're really focused on some of these bare necessities. But the realities that I started to see around me of, you know, addiction and constant workaholism and a lot of physical illness in myself, in other people, that really did start to scare me, because I had already made, I think, an implicit commitment to being involved in social movements as a lifelong vocation. And the question really arose, how do we possibly sustain this work over the arc of a lifetime if people are like succumbing to all these different, forces that are taking them out of the work?
Well, let's take a look at a few of those forces. You mentioned addiction for one. Talk about that and how it affects the activist.
Yeah. And I want to say that from the very beginning, I noticed this among the students we were working with and the older folks. So it was kind of across the board. I think what happens is when things get hard, we look for distraction, and we all find that in different places. We all have our preferred, you know, medicinal element, whatever that is. For some people, it's reality TV. For some people, it's alcohol, you know, whatever. And you can use any of those things responsibly, I think, maybe even reality TV. I'm not sure about that one. But when you are so caught up in a sense of urgency and possibly despair, you really, it's very easy to go for something that's going to numb you out a little bit to that. And I saw that quite a bit. And I started to lose friends, you know, literally lose friends, like suicide and medical illness that went undetected or untreated. And that scared me as well, because people that I so revered in the activist world taking their own lives, I mean, that's like ground zero, right? That you just, that's the thing you want to prevent, bottom line.
Right. Well, and the destructive behaviors, even if you don't take your own life, you become utterly unaffected, ineffective. You're hurting yourself. You're hurting people around you is part of what's going on there. Addiction, workaholism, which can be a kind of another addiction where you get sort of so caught up in the work that you allow other things, personal relationships, to suffer.
Totally. And I think that what happens is we form a certain identity and it becomes very single-minded. I think it kind of goes back to the narcissism. Most activists I know probably wouldn't identify necessarily with that term, but it would be useful to consider it because, you know, and people have grown a lot. So I don't want to, I don't know very many narcissists necessarily these days in movement work, but ego is a powerful thing. And we get really in love with the sense of our own power. And that needs to be checked.
Well, it's not as though narcissism is a genetic trait, right? I mean, it's the thing you become when you're not careful about how your motives have changed and what's really driving you these days, right?
I think so. And I think it's like the shadow, it's the other side of the coin of insecurity. I think the healthier people get in their relationship with themselves, you know, the less we need to worry about that.
So you're seeing these patterns emerge, and you're certainly seeing the results, the ineffectiveness, the destruction that it's causing, all in the hope of doing some good. How did you begin to develop treatments and ways to programs for renewal?
Yeah, very slowly and very experimentally. At that point, which was sort of early 90s, I didn't know a lot of other people that were thinking in this way. I was really starting to think about the connections between spirituality and activism. I had started my own meditation practice and started practicing yoga. And I wanted to create opportunities to explore what those practices and other practices could offer. And so I just started to gather local social change practitioners in Durham, actually, in circles that would meet on an ongoing basis. And we played around with things. And we did it. I led a lot of it, but a lot of it was peer led. And we learned a great deal. I came in not at all as an expert, but as someone that had some really juicy questions that I wanted folks to sit with.
What were some of the answers you were finding?
Gosh, so many answers. To mine your own personal history, to not, you know, just throw over whatever has happened to you in the past, to look at the impact of tradition and culture and to keep what is still beautiful and life-giving for you, to spend time in the natural world, no matter who you are. I think that every faith and spiritual tradition at the root has, you know, a very healthy relationship to nature, although it's phrased differently in different traditions. This connection with silence and some kind of contemplative life, I think, again, spanned across multiple lines of difference in terms of religion and spirit.
What happens in silence? Why is that important?
There's a reverend, his name is Walter Burkhart, and he talks about contemplative practice as a long, loving look at the real. And I think that's what happens in silence. I think we sit with ourselves and we sit with the totality of our own experience. And if we're lucky, we have a moment of friendliness with that. We get to transcend whatever shame or guilt or anxiety, fear, anger, all the kind of regular ways that we might relate to parts of ourselves. We have the opportunity to kind of put that to the side and tap into our true nature, which is complete love and beauty.
How much of that is a requirement for the activist who has to get, you know, back to themselves and feeling renewed? And what by that I mean confronting some of your actual motives and having to say to yourself, you know, I may have gotten into this for the wrong reason. I may have wanted to be famous for being the person who solved the problem of homelessness. And that's a tough thing to come to if you feel like that's a kind of an egocentric idea. You would never have admitted that about yourself. And there you are at some point in the midst of the silence saying, oh, look at me.
Right. Totally. And it's such an awesome opportunity to practice some self-compassion. I think there are all kinds of ways people get into the work that they do. And that evolves. And it only evolves with the awareness. I mean, when I started doing any kind of spiritual practice, I just was trying to manage stress. I didn't know anything about the possibility of liberation or enlightenment. You know, that wasn't even on my radar screen, that I could sort of be an exemplar of kindness 100% of the time. Sort of now I think of that as my goal, but I wasn't then. And I think the same is true with what you're talking about. I think that there's no shame in our starting points. We all come from such a complex and tangled history. We're the product of so much, you know, our ancestral lineage, our cultural lineage, societal norms. So for me, what you're talking about is just the starting place to begin to unravel it. It's not the ending place.
Right. It's a tough thing to have to come to acknowledge, but you realize if you're going to have compassion for the big wide world out there, then you need to have compassion for yourself when you discovered something that you may not have been so proud of.
Absolutely. I mean, the Buddha said you could look all the world over and you will never find someone more deserving of your compassion than yourself. And I think that's true because it's practice, right? And so we practice on the instrument that we have all the time, which is ourselves. And a lot, you know, sometimes I still hear this thing of like, well, isn't it selfish to do this spiritual work or, you know? And for me, I feel so strongly that we interact with people all the time and they're getting whatever we bring to them. If we're raggedy, they're getting that raggediness. If we're feeling coherent and calm, then they get that. And I want people to get the best of me. I want to get the best of others. And I do feel really strongly that some attention to spiritual life helps that happen.
And the flip side of that, it seems to me, is that for the activist, it helps bring them low and humble to understand that the people they're working with, and it's a very easy thing to do, is not another species. When you talk about addictions, when you talk about self-loathing, when you talk about this need for compassion, all of those things there are characteristics that we find among the populations that we're trying to help. And then the distance between us, it seems to me, might shrink if we go through this kind of process.
Absolutely. I mean, we are an interdependent species. You know, we just are. And I think that this new normal in the economy has shown us yet again that anything can happen to anyone. You know, that you can think you've been on sure footing, let's say, economically, and actually you're not. Or you have an addicted parent you just find out about. Or, I mean, these things span every age, class, background, you know, so...
How did it evolve into what you have now? You talked about experimenting and just working with people to relieve stress. When did it occur to you that this is something that needs to be programmatic and institutionalized?
It was within the first few years. We were getting a lot of interest. I would show up at conferences around the country to organize dialogues around this, and they would shove us in the smallest possible room in the hotel, and we would have overflow, you know. And people were like, "Oh, I guess people are interested in this conversation." So we started doing more training. We started creating more, you know, organized programming. I always wanted us to have a physical space because I think it's a marker of something. And I think a lot can happen in physical space. And I always had the intention, you know, in my belly to have some place like the Stonehouse. And in 2007, this piece of land came up for sale that the Human Kindness Foundation had been stewarding, and it was perfect for us. And I think we just knew right away that we were going to do what we had to do to purchase it and make it fly as a nonprofit, which is very unusual. Most centers like ours have a big church or university behind them, but we're doing it more based on community support.
How much do you find that religious tradition plays a part in this, and then non-religious? I mean, spiritual is certainly a word that comes up often on the website. It's a word that you use regularly. How much of that is religious, and how much of that is sort of a non-religious, sort of deeper spiritual idea?
I think it's a really healthy mix. We have had retreats for Yom Kippur at the Stonehouse. We've had a number of church groups, Episcopal deacons out there. We've had Quakers out there. We had a East Coast Rastafarian community has done a big festival out there. Buddhist communities. For me, what's fascinating is what if you are deepening in a spiritual or a religious path, there is something of integrity at the core of that that you share with other people that have also gone deep in their own path. And that place of integrity is like an adherence to a value system, to a way of being, to a way of nurturing others into that path. I mean, it looks different. You know, the Rastas do it different than the Buddhists do it. But the level of integrity with which people are holding that is so similar. And I've been really struck by that, how those similarities actually outweigh some of the more surface differences.
But some of the things they have in common, it seems to me, is one, and we talked about this earlier, there is ritual. There's something that we do every day. And then there is a community that we don't just do it by ourselves. It's not just me and my spirit. It's me, my spirit, and those people holding me accountable. Are those things important?
Absolutely. I mean, social change is it's a collective enterprise. You can't do it without community. And I think one of the things I've been really interested in, which we do a lot with, is how do we make those communities function at the highest level? It's one thing to have a value system and to practice that with yourself. It's a whole different thing to scale that up to groups of people, particularly when they're more diverse, right? Not as homogeneous. So activists tend to be a fairly diverse group. And we need to learn how to really function well together, to work through conflicts, to be able to hear each other, to honor the differences of opinion without letting them become, you know, fissures. So I'm really fascinated by how that happens and what that technology looks like.
Listening is a very important concept in Stonehouse.
It is.
Tell us about that. Why listen? I mean, silence is important, so you're listening to something there, but listening to each other.
Listening to each other, listening to ourselves, and listening to the natural world. I think for some people who come there, what they hear from the natural world is the most profound because they've actually never heard the wind the way they hear it out there. And that becomes an opening that was unexpected. Listening to each other in an environment like that, where someone has prepared a gorgeous plate of food for you, and you don't have to wash those big pots, and you're just sitting across a table that might remind you of your grandmother's kitchen table, or it might not. It's a very different kind of connection than sitting around a conference table or at a protest.
And I would think it's a hard thing for activists to do. Look, I've got an idea, and it's not the dominant idea. So I really have to say it over and over again to tell people that a criminal justice system can't keep putting away the same kind of people the way it does and still be fair, right? And you have to say it over and over again because nobody sees it. So it's hard, I suppose, for the activist whose job it is to get attention and to make you understand to actually sit down and listen. Is that a hard thing?
I think so. I mean, but I think what's amazing is you look at what the NAACP and others are doing around sort of trying to bring greater threads of justice and equity into our state legislature. And I feel like, you know, they are embodying this connection of spirituality and activism because there is a very clear, you know, reiteration of what is being sacrificed through some of the legislation that's coming down right now. But there is also prayer and there is vigil and there is connection and there is singing and there is handholding. And those things are not props for the cameras. You know, those are real dynamic experiences that allow people to engage on an ongoing basis. That for me is the sweet spot.
On the State of Things today, Claudia Horwitz, Executive Director of Stone Circles at Stonehouse, and our conversation will continue in a moment. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Claudia Horwitz, Executive Director of Stone Circles at Stonehouse. She's written a book called The Spiritual Activist, and she's here with us in the studio. So you talked about space. You wanted a space out there that has lots of natural landscape, lots of good food that comes in from local farmers that feeds the body, and then the mind and soul get fed as well. Time is very important, and silence and listening are important. Time is also another important thing. You and I are going to be on a panel a week from Thursday at the Durham Library talking about this kind of sacred notion of time, one that certainly has escaped us in modern life. We treat time rather badly, don't we?
We do. I think the disconnection from nature and the disconnection from kind of a sacred sense of time go hand in hand. I had never lived in a rural place before I moved to the Stonehouse and had never really worked land before. And I think becoming aware of the rhythms of the moon and degree of rainfall, it really shifts your perspective on time. Tremendously. I've been really grateful for that. And I'm looking forward to the panel. I think it's going to be great.
Well, and that's the point. We'd never feel like we have enough time, which again, increases the sense of anxiety and stress, and don't see ourselves in these patterns of life, death, and renewal, and understand that this moment of failure is part of a pattern that if we were paying more attention to time, we might be more comfortable with, knowing that we'll wake up tomorrow, be in a different place, and there's greater hope for change.
Absolutely. I think part of it is we're trying to do too many things. Mm-hmm. We are overexposed to the world. You know, it can be a beautiful thing, but it can be a bit dangerous also in terms of what we're trying to do with our lives. And we think we're supposed to do everything. I think that it's great to fall in love with a lot of different things and work and people and hobbies. But at some point, you have to decide, you know, what are these three or four doorways that is going to create a life that I can feel good about and proud of and that is going to keep me connected to what I care most about? And then can I let the rest go? That's a hard choice.
Well, it's a humble relationship, isn't it, with our attachment to the outcome. It's one thing to get out, put your shoes on every day and do the hard work, knowing that you want a particular outcome. But letting go of your control over the outcome, that's a hard thing for activists?
I think it's a very hard thing. And I think there's an extent to which, for me, it's a short-term, long-term sort of paradox. I feel sometimes if we could keep the longer-term perspective in mind, we would probably make better short-term decisions and we would grasp a little less tightly to the outcomes. You know, the more that people have studied history and the history of social movements, the more they're able to see sort of patterns and cycles. And I think the more they're able to put things in that context.
And this is where we get back to this idea of ritual and doing, you know, sort of and patterns of behavior. And you see that as essential to political organizing.
I really do. I really do, because we are full people. We are full people. We have not just bodies and not just heads, but we have, as you said, we have spirits, we have souls. They have to be nurtured. And if we only do that individually, we miss out on this incredible collective energy. I think we're really missing out on fuel if neglect that.
Well, forgive me for interrupting there, but what about the people who say, look, this is all nonsense. This is just an escape. There are people with real material problems out there. They don't have enough food. They don't have enough education. They're worried about the police every minute. These are real material problems. And while you're up in the ether over there giving people comfort, these people are suffering every day. And you're nothing but a distraction.
Well, I think you have to be careful. I mean, I do think that you can get sucked in to spiritual life in such a way that you can completely lose touch with what's actually happening in the world. And I don't think that's healthy either. But I don't know very many successful activists and leaders throughout history. There's prominent examples to point to and less prominent, who did not have some kind of regular way of returning to that essence and to the core.
What about people who've been through your program? Do they come back? Because that's the other danger, is that you have a retreat, everything went well, and for the next week, you're pretty well grounded, and then there's the following week.
Right, exactly. They do come back, which is great. We love folks to come back. We try to prepare people for the fact that, you know, this is not a silver bullet. It's not like you walked, you know, through some, I don't know, threshold that you're never going to, you know, return. It's a practice, right? And so you have to sort of see how you can keep nurturing that commitment on a regular basis.
Do you work with individuals and organizations? Do you work with a whole organization to say, here's something you can build into your daily routine as you...
We do. We run a lot of retreat programs, mostly for individuals. And then the training that we do, which is much more skills focused, tends to be for leaders from organizations or teams of people from organizations. Because after we had been doing work for individuals for a while, we had people saying, well, this is great. I've developed my practice, but I still have to go back to the same dysfunctional organization every day. So help me with that. And so we've developed some deeper practices training that's much more about that.
Context. Are those trainings and practices much different from sort of business workshops and any other sort of organizational workshops that try to get people to work together more functionally?
There's definitely some overlap. I think that the business world has had a lot of resources to put into that kind of learning. And so there's actually been quite a stream of great wisdom that's come out of that sector. And some of it's been adapted really well for the social change sector. And then some of it, you know, comes up in a different way.
Talking about resources, you're trying to get a new kitchen, I guess, huh?
We are. We're trying to create a larger kitchen on site so that we can feed more people. We have, just these amazing cooks. We're doing a cookbook right now of all our recipes. And so we're doing an Indiegogo campaign. And if folks go to our website, which is stonecircles.org, they'll see the link there to the Indiegogo campaign, which is called Feeding the Heart. And we're about a third of the way towards our goal. We want to raise $80,000 for this kitchen. And with folks' help out there, we'll get there.
So if the food's good now, it's going to be better later.
Exactly.
That sounds good. You talked about starting out in Philadelphia, getting active there. Now you're in North Carolina. What brought you here?
You know, I came down here originally to go to graduate school. I did a master's in public policy at Duke. I thought I wanted to close the gap between grassroots organizers and policymakers. I saw a huge division there. And what I realized through that program was that that wasn't my work. That was somebody else's work. And I, at the same time, had started more of a spiritual life. And so I came to found Stone Circles. But I felt in love with Durham and North Carolina. I can't imagine living anywhere else. I think this state is one of the most incredible places in the country, both in terms of its challenges and its beauties. I love the role of stories here and the ways that people connect to each other. And I've loved Durham. I mean, it's still probably the best place I've ever lived.
You know, in terms of political organizing, it has a remarkable history and political activism on all sides of the spectrum here. It's kind of an interesting place for that, isn't it?
Totally. And I have found so many amazing mentors and teachers as a result of that. I feel really blessed.
You talked about conversation, keeping things in conversation, and the fact that in North Carolina there's this kind of diversity here and the tensions that we feel both on the right and the left. How much of this do you think these practices are aimed at trying to generate a conversation across that divide, across that ideological divide. I mean, it's one thing to get sort of public attention, to get people to, who may be in the middle, to focus on something that they hadn't. And quite another to ask the activist on the other side to sit down at the table with you and see what we have in common and how we can go forward. Yeah.
You know, it's a great question. I would actually like to do more of that. I feel like those opportunities don't present themselves very easily. Certainly not here, I think, in general. You have to work really hard. There are certain issues that arise. You know, there was a wave around the abortion issue where I felt like some of that was happening. I love those opportunities because, you know, if people can connect with their humanity across those lines of difference, something's going to shift. You know, if we walk into a conversation not necessarily trying to change each other's minds, but to try to understand it better, that's a bonus. That said, I mean, I feel really strongly in a vision of justice and equity. Like that's, you know, I have a value system that says like we need to work for that. And I'm interested in ideological differences where we can come to that place,
right.
You know, but maybe from different starting places.
What about that great middle? People who, if they were a little more conscious of what was going on or could see some of the patterns of injustice, might be more likely to work for justice. You talk about sort of having read the autobiography of Malcolm X and your political awakening.
Yeah.
Tell us about that and sort of how that relates to the whole question of activism. On this scene.
Yeah, I think that for me, what that helped me realize, I mean, I got that book, you know, by divine accident when I was in college. I think that you never know where someone's justice nerve is going to get turned on or how. You never know. And what I love is when people approach campaigns and projects, I think all of us and see, you know, the part of the fight against Amendment 1 was a great example of this, but there are many others where we are going to try to reach a wide array of people beyond the usual suspects. We're going to put the word out. We're going to create environments where that might attract people into that. I mean, when there was the fight against the war, the Iraq war, that happened. You had so many people coming out against that war. That was something that, you know, folks who had never been to a protest before were out there in the street. They didn't even think of themselves as activists. Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the most important and undervalued things that social change folks can do.
And as more and more people were affected, both soldiers who came back and understood the reality of what they were being asked to do and see that the kind of theatrics, the dramatic tableau that they thought they were walking into was not at all the picture, came back and they had stories. The families of people who've lost people started feeling different. So I guess your personal contact with the story, that's the other thing. It's not abstract anymore. It's a real thing.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why I think stories are so powerful. You know, and it's one of the things I love about your show and a lot of the other stuff on public radio, some of our more interesting independent media, you know, telling the stories of people whose lives have been very complex and whose actual lives have crossed those ideological lines and divides. You know, it's not so neat. It gets a little bit messy. And then we have to engage with that messiness in ourselves, you know, the complexity of beliefs that we might hold.
Yeah, we're not these sanitized heroes that we read about. It turns out our hero is just like me. So I could be one too. I could be one too. Is it getting harder these days for activists? Is it a tougher world to be a part of?
I don't think so. I don't ever believe that. I hear people saying this is a challenging political moment. And certainly I would say in North Carolina, this is a challenging time. But you could put your finger on the bullseye of almost any moment throughout history anywhere. And there would be a constellation of challenges, repressive policies, you know, belief systems that are very tricky. I don't think this is any more difficult than any other. And I do believe there's some evolutionary wave that kind of draws us closer and closer towards justice.
Well, this business of sort of people in the middle being comfortable enough not to engage, you know, if you think about the trajectory of social activism from a time when workers themselves were actively working to gain leverage in the workplace against the capital that was. They were the ones. They were on the front lines and they were experiencing it. If you look at just very broadly in the 60s, things get more abstract. Students who aren't working talk about things like freedom of speech, freedom of sexual expression. These aren't working conditions anymore. These aren't, and they're not on the front lines. Have we, do we have to get back to engaging the people and becoming more engaged with the people who are actual victims of social injustice? And are we good enough at that? Have our organizations lost touch with or are in danger of losing touch?
I think yes to everything you just said, not to be Pollyanna about it. I think that, yes, there has been some losing touch. I think the more that the nonprofit, you know, some people talk about the nonprofit industrial complex, the more institutionalized the work for change becomes, the easier it is to sever contact, you know, with what's actually happening on the ground. And it becomes more of a profession. I don't think that's totally bad, because I want folks to be able to dedicate their lives to this kind of work. And if that means that they're getting a salary and healthcare, I'm okay with that. But there's a shadow side to that. There's a downside to it. And I think we have to be really vigilant about what you're talking about, because that dynamic can present itself where we're just too far away. But I guess I'm an, I don't want to say I'm an optimist, but I do have, I have a lot of faith. I have a lot of faith in us as a human, human race. It may be ill-founded, but it's important to me.
Is the funding getting more difficult? Is it more difficult now to try to pay for these enterprises?
It is more difficult, partly with the market crash in 2008. You know, a lot of foundation endowments took a hit, and we've seen the impact of that. People who have money invested in the stock market who give as individual donors, you know, same phenomenon. Something that I really love about how we're funded is we have about a third of our money comes from individual donors, a third from foundations, and a third is earned income from renting the Stonehouse out to groups. And I do feel like for folks that are creating or maintaining nonprofit organizations, figuring out how to create an income stream that you earn yourself is vital. And I'm a bit of a preacher about this with folks. I love helping people think about it.
You're clearly very happy doing what you're doing now. It seems to be very fulfilling. But as you see these activists come through working on their particular causes, are you ever pulled back into that and asking, you know, or thinking to yourself, should I be doing that?
Yes. And I do actually try to stay very connected to particular campaigns on an ongoing basis. So I was really involved in the anti-war work for a few years. I was a little bit involved in the Amendment 1 work. So now we're doing more work around food justice. And I've been a little bit involved in that because, you know, we can see the sort of beginnings of two food systems, yep. One that works for folks that have resources and one that doesn't, works for folks who don't have resources. So I do try to stay connected. I can't imagine a life where, you know, you're just behind the scenes or in that space. But, you know, it never feels like enough. So,
Claudia, we'll let you right back at it. We'll say goodbye, and then you can go right back to work. Claudia Horwitz, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thanks, Frank. It was great to be here.
Claudia Horwitz, Executive Director of Stone Circles at Stonehouse. You can learn more about them at WUNC.org. And that's our program for today. Thanks for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.